Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's weekly media roundtable. This is the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And today we're going to spend the hour talking about Baltimore. But I should note that we booked this show long before Donald Trump's latest racist Twitter rant, which continues to receive widespread media coverage. Today we are speaking with award-winning journalist Lawrence Lanahan. In 2012, as a producer at WYPR, a public radio station in Baltimore, Lawrence Lanahan led a year-long investigation about racial inequity in Baltimore. The result was a 50-episode series called The Lines Between Us, and it won a 2014 Alfred I. DuPont Award. His new book grew out of that work. It's called The Lines Between Us, Two Families and a Quest to Cross Baltimore's Racial Divide. In the book, Lawrence details the history of racism and segregation in Baltimore through the racial lens, ban lens, in housing policies, education, and economic opportunities. He writes, quote, "Inequality in Baltimore is so complex and deeply rooted that much remained unexplored. As I considered writing a book about segregation and racial inequality in Baltimore, events elsewhere, and particularly the death in 2014 of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, revealed similar dynamics at work in other regions. Across America, wealth and health followed whiteness, and people and places were penalized for blackness," end quote. So what do past and present housing policies reveal about the history of racism and segregation in this country, and what is being done to create an inclusive and anti-racist society? Lawrence Lanahan was a producer at WYPR's Maryland Morning from 2009 to 2013. He produced The Lines Between Us, a year-long multimedia series about regional inequality. And Lawrence Lanahan joins us from the studios of WYPR in Baltimore. Hi, Lawrence. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. It's great to talk to you again. Thanks.
Well, it's great to have you. We spoke with you when you won the Polk Award for your series back in 2014. And then in April of 2015, the horrible death of Freddie Gray became really international headline news. And we saw a lot more coverage of the racial divide in Baltimore. Now, we booked you to talk about your book way before Trump went off on Twitter, but for various reasons, you couldn't come on until now. So I have to ask you about this. What are your thoughts about the reactions to these bigoted comments?
We're just so used to it here. Baltimore's always been kind of a punchline for what's not really a joke. The setup is, you know, 100 years of racist policies. That created, if I don't like the term ghetto, but for lack of a better term, that created the black ghetto in Baltimore. The Kerner Commission addressed it in the 60s. You know, white America created and condones it. You know, we just never learn. To see it used as this transparent, facile campaign tool, not just a campaign tool. I mean, he's definitely, like, pumping up his supporters by associating black faces with troubled black spaces. But he's also doing it to distract from, you know, the investigations that Cummings wants to do. It's just so easy to see through, and it's a distraction. You know, here's the analogy that I was thinking of last night when I was up in the middle of the night, annoyed with everything that's going on. And it's like, it's Thanksgiving, and you're at the grown-up table, and you're having a nice conversation, and somebody comes over from the kids' table, right, and has a tantrum, like, "I want your gravy, it's better!" And you're like, "No, it's the same gravy, it's just we're serving it with the nice china." "But I want the nice gravy." And you're like, we're trying to have a nice conversation here. Can you go back to the kids' table? Ah! You know, we've been having, especially since Freddie Gray, a very sophisticated conversation about racial equity, about the causes of racial inequality. And this is just so, so childish, all of it. And it's a distraction. And we're annoyed. We're annoyed. You know, but we're used to the cameras coming in and out of this place, and we know they're going to go away, and we'll get back to doing what we were doing before Trump tweeted that.
So this is getting nonstop media coverage, and as you said, you've got 100 years of racist policies. I mean, you laid out so many of these policies in your book. What do you think about how specifically the national media are covering this?
To tell you the truth, I haven't paid too much attention. One thing I did see in the New York Times Was Emily Badger wrote a piece, and she interviewed me for this. And she wrote a piece that was just, what can the federal government actually do to help Baltimore? And what has it done to hurt it in the last 100 years? And it talked about affirmatively furthering fair housing and getting rid of lead poisoning and reforming the Baltimore police. And it was just a very, very grown-up analysis of why Baltimore is the way it is and what power the government actually has, which was kind of my motivation in writing the book, you know, sort of launching off from the radio series. We ended on an episode that said, what power does government have? Does it dismantle the structural drivers of segregation and racial inequality? Hmm. And that's what her piece did. Like, you can do this, you can do that. And it turns out Ben Carson is sort of unraveling the civil rights tools that we have to compel integration and racial equality.
And we'll talk about the power the government has in a minute, but I also just wanted to mention this really damning editorial from the Baltimore Sun, which a lot of people are talking about, and I think the headline says it all, better to have a few rats than to be one.
Yeah, that's us. That's Baltimore. We're always going to scrap back. You know, it's just a matter of taking a swipe back without stooping to his level, which is hard to do.
Right.
Which is hard to do. We were having a grown-up conversation about segregation and racial inequality before Trump tweeted it. We're going to keep doing it when he's gone. And the temptation is just to ignore it. But he has just captured the media. And he actually influences the perception of this place. And we're not going to have it. You know, on my way here, the driver was actually a fan of the station near WYPR. And I was like, that's where you're dropping me off. And we saw a couple of guys in a black neighborhood with rakes cleaning up trash. And I was like, oh, I want to get a picture. And he was like, let me back up and let you get a good picture. And I took a picture of these guys cleaning up, you know, a bus stop that had some trash. And I mean, the fact that Baltimore has trash isn't news, even though Fox tried to play it that way in Trump. It's not news to us that people clean up and care about their communities. That's just the childish level to which this conversation has descended. And I cannot wait for it to pick back up and for us to get to talk about it the way you guys have always wanted to talk about it. With me. Mm. A very grown-up conversation.
Grown-up conversation. Before we dive into your book, I mean, you have lots of stats in the book, but just to give people some information, there was another good piece in the New York Times called Baltimore to Trump, You Lost Your Authority to Criticize. And Cheryl mm-hmm. Gay Stolberg is reporting from Baltimore, and she notes that Baltimore is 63% black. The population is about 662,000, is that right?
We're closer to like 606, 610. It's going down.
Okay, so about 610,000, 63% black. She writes, it's struggling with long-term systemic problems and unstable political leadership. It's gone through 5 police commissioners in the past 5 years. The city has recorded at least 33 more homicides than New York, despite being 1/14 the size. The mayor who presided during the unrest did not run for re-election, and her successor was forced to resign amid a corruption scandal. What else can you tell us about Baltimore for people who are not really familiar with it, other than maybe, and I don't know how you feel about this reference, but The Wire, and then the horrible death of Freddie Gray? And now this. So people who don't really have never been to Baltimore, don't know much about it. What else do people need to know about the city today?
That it's a beautiful place with beautiful people. I mean, I used to be pretty chauvinistic about Baltimore. Like, I would move away, but then come back and spend all my time here. There's just so much. There's this liberating weirdness. There is this just kind of strong local flavor. It's just a lovable city. And the challenges that are here draw people together and create really strong community. It's tough to live here. Nobody always loves being here, but we are really fiercely proud. And since Freddie Gray, we're more able to talk about it together. I mean, there are kind of two worlds here based on race and class, but since Freddie Gray, at least the people who have dedicated themselves to organizing and activism have forced a more uncomfortable conversation about why we are the way we are. So it's a beautiful place to be. And I think there are probably other cities like St. Louis, New Orleans. I mean, there's two ways to talk about New Orleans, right? Mm. You know, that just all the crises and problems and violence, et cetera, that they have. But America has a better picture of what's beautiful about New Orleans. We got the same stuff here. It's a wonderful place to be. I've lived here most of the last 19 years. It is hard to live here sometimes, but you go other places and it's just kind of like, I don't know. It's a little, almost like a little too easy in other places. You've got these super cities like San Francisco and New York and Washington, D.C., where you pay five times as much to be there. And it's like, are you getting five times as much in return? And I know San Francisco is amazing. I love going there. And, you know, you guys know what's beautiful about San Francisco, but Baltimore is no different than any other American city. It has its challenges, and it has an amazing community.
And we have our share of challenges, for sure.
Yes, you do.
We have so many. And just to give listeners a little more information about you, Lawrence, in the book you write, I have been a witness to whiteness in this region my whole life. I grew up in a small suburban town outside Baltimore that was 95% white, the kind of place where white strangers felt perfectly comfortable making racist comments in front of me. As a young person, despite feeling like I knew who the real racists and bigots were, I casually indulged in racist jokes, stereotypes, and slurs. It's easy to tell yourself that you're not actually racist in a place that is so white.
When a place is so white, you have these incredible gradations of what is racist. And so you grow up there and you think it's normal. I mean, you have to do a lot of work as a community to make yourself 95% white in a country that's not nearly that white. And so that never struck me. That never struck me because who was around me to challenge it and tell me that it was any different anywhere else? And so I ended up going to a state college that was 80% white. And like that 15, just that little 15% made all the difference. I mean, I was socializing with kids from Howard County, Montgomery County, Prince George's County, places closer to D.C. that were much more diverse. Their social groups were much more diverse. And you look back at Harford County where I grew up and you're like, oh no, that wasn't normal at all. That was not normal at all. And it just completely changed the way I saw the culture where I grew up and American culture. And really is when I dedicated myself to kind of unraveling and exposing that culture and the social structures that enabled it.
And you've lived in Baltimore City for 14 of the past 18 years, and you've reported on the dynamics of segregation and racial inequality for over a decade.
Yeah, and not just here. I mean, one of the first stories I did as a journalist is I heard that in New Orleans, 12 days after the storm, they took about 140 of the last stragglers. I mean, these are people that had serious problems with addiction and mental health and stuff. They were still in the city. They put them on National Guard trucks, took them to the airport, put them on an airplane, and halfway through the flight, the pilot said, "We'll be landing in Nebraska in an hour." Mm-hmm. And they were like, "Nebraska?" And Omaha tried to welcome them with open arms, at least white Omaha did that. And then when it became clear how many problems they arrived with, people kind of backed off a little bit. And by the time I got there a year after, most of them were living in the projects. Like Omaha had actually found apartments for them in the projects. And so this happens everywhere. We have white America as a whole has this desire to be separate. And whether they know it or not, you know, that preserves the advantages that they have. That's why we have these lines. So, you know, after living here for 14 of the last 18 years, I mean, it's just in a way all you see when you're trying to live in a place and have just one community.
The new book you wrote, The Lines Between Us, is an expanded version of your year-long investigation about the racial divide in Baltimore. Can you remind us of that investigation and what you were, I mean, you explored so many things. It ended up turning into a very long series, 50 episodes. But give us, just remind us what that series was about.
Sure. I had just been a producer for a news interview program here for a couple of years. And it just seemed like inequality, segregation, disparities were the backstory to so much of what we were talking about. Baltimore is one of 10 hyper-segregated regions in America. And it's very clear just walking around here block to block that that's true. And so white people talked about that, but they talked about it with white people. Black people talked about it with black people. But I didn't feel like there was enough sort of getting together and really having the difficult conversations about why that was and how it could change. And I figured, you know, the airwaves are free. Anybody can listen. What if we turn this into a sort of hub to have these conversations and do the research and reporting? And so we just decided every Friday on Maryland Morning we would do it. I hired a group of social scientists to do data maps so people could see what we were talking about. And I said, let's start with housing. We'll figure out why housing is segregated, why we have a racial wealth gap, which has everything to do with housing. And then we'll get into economic development and jobs. We'll get into the criminal justice system and mass incarceration. We'll get into education. And even in 50 episodes, that's as far as we got. There was more I wanted to do, and there was just so much to talk about that that's as far as we got. And you learn. I hope listeners, but I certainly learned so much about why this place is the way it is and the sort of natural landing point for us in that last episode, which was recorded at a public event. We had like 200 people out. Nicole Hannah-Jones, who's now at the New York Times Magazine and is writing a book about school segregation, was one of the panelists. And I was like, what power does local, state, and federal government have to dismantle this stuff? It's clear that we have it. Our feel-good ways of dealing with it, our post-racial way of dealing with it, clearly isn't making a difference. So what power? You know, like the federal government, when the Civil Rights Act came along in 64, suddenly you were not allowed to discriminate using federal funds. And that is how they finally got the South to start desegregating schools. There was massive resistance for 10 years. And then it was like, okay, we're going to break your backs here. We're going to withhold funding. And they got moving. You could do that with housing here. There's a provision in the Fair Housing Act called Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing that compels anybody getting HUD funding to take actual proactive steps to undo the segregation and inequality that previous policies caused. HUD's very rarely withheld funding. There are tools in government to force people to reckon with this, but it just doesn't happen, and it's definitely not happening under Trump.
You did a lot of research for this book. You conducted over 200 interviews, collected over 700 newspaper and magazine articles, read scores of research articles, looked at transcripts at federal courthouses, unearthed audio and video recordings. I mean, you did a lot of research for this book, Lawrence. What would you say? I mean, you learned so much during doing your radio series. What was new? I mean, what really struck you about the research you did for your book? Does anything really stand out?
What stands out is the narrative, the organizing. You know, the series is very topical. Let's talk about housing. Let's talk about education. Let's do this segment about this thing. And what I did, as I said, you know, there's already this great book here called Not in My Neighborhood, How Bigotry Shaped the Great American City by Andrew Piattila that talks about Baltimore in 1910 having the first municipal segregation ordinance. You know, like black people can't live on white blocks and vice versa. Supreme Court upended that, and there were restrictive covenants in people's deeds. You can't rent or sell to blacks or Jews. Supreme Court upended that. And he goes up to about the 1970s. Well, you know, people kind of look at America and race relations as, you know, before Jim Crow and after Jim Crow, before the Civil Rights Movement and after the Civil Rights Movement. And people have a harder time talking about after we had these laws passed to get rid of these problems. And Baltimore is almost as segregated now as it was before the Fair Housing Act. So I thought, what if I start investigating this narrative in the late 60s? And then when Freddie Gray died, I was like, oh, and I see where this book is going. That's the climax. We go from the Fair Housing Act to Freddie Gray. How did we get there? And I didn't even know that in 1970, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights had a 3-day hearing in Baltimore County at the Social Security Administration headquarters about suburban real estate discrimination. I learned that Baltimore County's population, the county that mostly surrounds the city, their population grew by like 300,000 or 400,000 people between 1950 and 1970. Well, the black population during that time went down by 1,000 black people from 50 to 60, and then went up by like 2,500. Like, how do you get 200,000 to 300,000 new white people and expel black people? What are these policies? And that is what the hearing was about. It was a 3-day hearing. There was a bomb threat during the hearing. And the chairman of the commission said, I hear a lot of these problems living in separate worlds. The city is black, the county is white, but nobody seems to be doing anything wrong. I don't see how that's true. And they talked about how discrimination had become much less overt, that people started making policies that were ostensibly neutral. You know, like, oh, we're going to zone for single family zoning here. We're not going to have apartments. People still get upset around here when there's a new apartment building. They just assume it's Section 8, you know. My mom told me up in Bel Air in Harford County where I grew up, she said, oh my gosh, you should hear people are talking about, oh, there's this new apartment building, it's going to be Section 8. I investigated it. It's a luxury apartment complex. So I just learned how people covered their tracks, how they gave themselves plausible deniability, how when people's preferences were given free rein after the Fair Housing Act, how people institutionalized their prejudices to keep things the way they were, how you made places like where I grew up that stayed so white for so long.
You know, it's so important to talk about history, and you know, you cannot do it in a soundbite. You reference Richard Rothstein in your book, and he mm-hmm. wrote that incredible book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten yeah. History of How Our Government Segregated America. And he wrote a piece called From Ferguson to Baltimore. And he writes, in 1925, 18 Baltimore neighborhood associations came together to form the Allied Civic and Protective Association for the purpose of urging both new and existing property owners to sign restrictive covenants, which mm-hmm. committed owners never to sell to African Americans.
And they call those associations improvement associations. Does that sound like an improvement to you?
Wow. This is the kind of thing that we need to be reminded of, I think, over and over again. Where neighbors jointly signed a covenant, any one of them could enforce it by asking a court to evict an African American family who purchased property in violation.
Right. I have a special list of people who I feel like were doing good structural reporting before, you know, like Freddie Gray. Richard Rothstein's definitely one of them. Peter Coy did a great piece about Ferguson for Bloomberg Business Week about how white people would move out of the city and incorporate a town, and then black people would move in and they'd move further out and incorporate a new town. And that's how St. Louis County has so many municipalities which compete against each other for revenue. They go to the bottom of the barrel and they end up relying for revenue on fines and fees, jaywalking, parking, which caused some of the tension that preceded Michael Brown's death. You know, so that stuff you're talking about is important, and it's shocking, and it's necessary to know that history. But what I really wanted to do is, like, take the sepia tone off of that. Make it color instead of black and white. Today, how do you get from that past the civil rights movement up to 2019, you know? And that's why it's so nettlesome, you know, when Donald Trump just does this plainly bigoted stuff and makes it, you know, calls black people racist and says, oh, black places are disgusting. We are trying to have a conversation about the structural drivers that are still happening, the unfinished business of the civil rights movement. And you're just dragging us back into, you know, stuff people were doing, you know, 70 years ago.
Before we get to present day, you have this incredible graph in your book, in a report prepared for a U.S. Commission on Civil Rights hearing. A graph shows the change in Baltimore County's white and black population between 1950 and 1970. This is what you were talking about
yeah.
earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just amazing. I mean, it goes 1950 to 1970. The line for the black population is almost at zero. And then you look at the total population and the white population, and it goes from about 300,000 in 1970 to about 600,000. I'm sorry, in 1950 to 600,000 in 1970. The font is really small there.
Yeah. That's a screenshot.
Right.
Out of an old report. To me, that just says everything. To people who say there's not structural racism, to say that, why do you have to make it about race? I don't see color. It's just like, look at that graph and tell me, one, huh, how did that happen? Is that just a coincidence? Like black people were just like, nah, suddenly I don't feel like living here anymore. All right, I don't want to move out there. And white people, like 300,000 showed up all at the same time, like, oh, hey, how did you get here, you know? That is not a coincidence. And also, when, to the degree that that was structural and incentivized by policy and people's prejudices, when did that stop? Was it the passage of the Fair Housing Act 7 days after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated? Was it June 17th, 1982? Was it December 5th, 1993? I mean, when did we become post-racial? We never did. But, I mean, I don't know. People say, you know, that this stuff isn't going on anymore, or that black people are racist, and they just have all these incredibly daft deflections from what's really going on. And you look at that graph, and it's like, when did it ever stop?
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break. Today we are joined by Lawrence Lanahan. We're talking about his new book, The Lines Between Us, Two Families and a Quest to Cross Baltimore's Racial Divide. Lawrence was a producer at WYPR's Maryland Morning from 2009 to 2013. When he was there, he produced The Lines Between Us, a year-long multimedia series about regional inequality, and it won a 2014 Alfred I. DuPont Award. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are joined by Lawrence Lanahan. We're talking about his new book, The Lines Between Us, Two Families and a Quest to Cross Baltimore's Racial Divide. When Lawrence was at WYPR, a public radio station in Baltimore, he produced a lengthy series, The Lines Between Us, a year-long series about regional inequality in Baltimore. It actually turned into a 50-episode series, and it won a 2014 Alfred I. DuPont Award. And we should say that we booked this show long before Donald Trump's latest racist Twitter rant, which still is receiving widespread media coverage. In fact, we had Lawrence on to talk about this series back in 2014, and now we're having him back on to talk about his book, which is basically the series, but way more in depth. Lawrence, I think this is a really important conversation. I mean, you say that you really wanted to look at what local, state, and federal politicians can do about this. And this was a really interesting comment from Kay Wise Whitehead on Democracy Now! She hosts Today with Dr. Kay on WEAA. Yes. She is also Associate Professor of Communication and African and American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland. And she said, you know, every day on our show, we talk about what's wrong with our city. We work to push and hold our politicians accountable. She said, but because of Donald Trump's tweets, right now, we cannot do that. We cannot call out politicians. Because of what Trump has done, he's put us all in defense mode, where we have to talk about how we're all Baltimore. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm glad you brought her up. She's great. She's a treasure in the city. It's like we've been trying to drive to someplace better, and we're going down the hill, and suddenly there's a flash flood, and you just got to wait for the water to go away. There are so many impediments to Baltimore's journey to true community, to real integration, to real racial equity. And some of those are our leadership. I mean, we didn't have a mayor for like a month. We didn't have a mayor. She kind of just disappeared because she got called out on self-dealing with, she was on the board of a hospital and sold hundreds of thousands of children's books she'd written to the hospital. And she got called out on it, and she just disappeared. Our police force is making it very hard for people, especially in black communities, to get justice. People in Baltimore expect crime from the police because of this gun trace task force, this elite group of police officers that just got put away for anywhere from 10 to 25 years for robbing people, doing home invasions, selling looted pharmaceuticals, planting guns. There are just so many problems in the institutions here. There are some encouraging things, right? You know, so like they passed a thing, a charter amendment saying that we need to do a racial equity analysis of any legislation that gets proposed. So now, you know, if somebody proposes a bill, there's a little section there that says who benefits. Is this going to perpetuate inequality and segregation or not? So it's there. You can't ignore it. We have an affordable housing trust fund, finally. It's going to be about $20 million a year. And the Housing and Community Development Department is about to start giving out the money. And all these people came out to a meeting, and everybody's organized, and there's this list of principles they want, including racial equity in the distribution of these funds. When Under Armour, the clothing manufacturer who has a headquarter here, when they wanted to build basically a new neighborhood in Baltimore with a corporate campus and retail and apartments and stuff, just hundreds and hundreds of people came out to demand local hiring and affordable housing. And like the baseline level of conversation in Baltimore got so sophisticated after Freddie Gray that outside of that city council hearing 2016, I mean, you should have seen the protest signs. Protest signs are supposed to be like, Black Lives Matter, no nukes, save the whales. And people were holding up signs that said, like, why don't we use tax increment financing to invest in black neighborhoods? Hmm. It's just, we're here, there, people are ready for something different. But the leadership and the civic leadership, the people with the money, aren't pushing far enough, not putting enough at risk, not being vulnerable enough to deal with whiteness, to deal with structural racism in a way that would really crack open this city a little bit.
Let's talk about the two main characters in your book. I mean, it's so interesting crossing the lines. They both really did cross the lines. Tell us a little bit first about Nicole Smith. You start off with her story. She's a Black mom in a poor neighborhood trying to find better opportunities for her son. And she lived with family in Murphy Homes, which is a high-rise public housing project. Tell us about Nicole.
So Nicole, she spent a little time in high-rise public housing. She and her mom, after her dad left, kind of bounced around a lot of different housing in West Baltimore. It's what they knew. It's what they could afford. And didn't really have a sense of themselves as experiencing injustice or segregation. That was just the water they swam in. But Nicole had a kid when she was 20. She was living with her mom, and her sister moved home and had a kid, and the house was just getting a little crowded, and there were a couple shootings on her block, and she just kind of knew she wanted to get out to give her son more opportunity. And so she eventually gets a special Section 8 housing voucher that was the remedy in a public housing desegregation lawsuit. Because she had lived in Murphy Homes, she qualified for this voucher. You could only use the voucher in parts of the region which were less than 26% minority population and had a poverty rate no higher than 10%, which is an amazing accomplishment, you know, because those are the communities that always resisted low-income housing. And it's a 17-year-long lawsuit, and it's a centerpiece of the book, but that is how advocates kind of cracked open the white suburbs for lower-income Black residents. Anyway, she's one of them, and she and her son move out to Columbia, which was a planned community. It was planned to be racially inclusive in the 60s. They basically built the city from scratch, and that's where she ended up. And things really got better for her and for her son. And I'm sure you'll ask me about the white couple, too. You know, the whole idea of putting these two families in the book was, if you want to see the lines between us, let's take people from either side of them and watch them cross.
Right.
Those lines come out in sharp relief, and you see how place and segregation, how whiteness and Blackness impacts their opportunities and their narrative and their life story.
And before we get to the white couple, Mark and Betty Lang, you mentioned the voucher that Nicole got, and I just think this is so important to talk about. So Section 8 vouchers, it's named for a federal program under which low-income households pay 30% of their income toward a rental in the private market, and the government paid the rest. You report that a voucher, as you said, offered the possibility of moving outside the city. The authorities' housing waiting list included 30,000 people.
Yes, people do want to move to where there's more opportunity when it is not provided where they are. And, you know, for every Nicole who finds some assistance to move to where the opportunity already is, there are many more who don't get it. And the neighborhoods where they are left behind, you do see some heavy investment to bring opportunity to where they already are, but not on a scale that really achieves any kind of systemic change.
You know, can we talk for a minute about opportunity? Because I've only been to Baltimore once. I moderated a discussion about an organization called SEVA that's trying to cure blindness around the world, and it was at Johns Hopkins University. Uh-huh. And it was a really quick trip. And when I checked into the hotel, I had to ask about the wire. I mean, I you know, I'm sure people in Baltimore can't stand that question, but I was having a nice chat with the guy, and I said, "Can I ask you a question, and please tell me if you're offended?" And he said, "No, I was actually a kid growing up in those projects while they were filming The Wire." And I said, "Oh, wow." I said, "So what has changed?" He said, "Nothing." He said, "In my opinion, it's nothing. The kids still don't have much to do." And I said, "How is that possible?" So it stuck with me, because here's this Johns Hopkins University, this beautiful campus. And then this guy that I met said, "Not that far away. We just don't have that many opportunities."
Yeah, not far at all. I mean, it's just so ingrained. I mean, it goes back so far to how the lines were drawn, where people could live, you know, who gets to live where, what investment goes into those places. And it's just the investment has never been comprehensive enough to make a change. And I write about Sandtown, the neighborhood where Freddie Gray was arrested before he died. A public-private partnership put over $100 million into that neighborhood in the 90s to try to totally transform it, you know, into a place where people would want to live that had the same crime and other, you know, issues as middle-class neighborhoods. And you see them trying. But in a neighborhood that gets so little investment, you know, it's almost like they get overwhelmed. If you're not taking 20, 30 years to cultivate the leaders, to figure out who the leaders already are, everything's too overwhelming. I mean, there were successes. They built like several hundred new houses and made them available to people who lived in the neighborhood or lived in poor neighborhoods. But then the foreclosure crisis came, and as many new homeowners as they got, you saw so many people lose their houses. There are national and global forces at work in these neighborhoods. And when you address it neighborhood by neighborhood, when you are timid in your reforms at the national level, the efforts will never get to scale.
What about local leadership in Baltimore? Are most of the politicians there Democrats?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we pay attention to the primary.
Okay, right. So it's like us in California. And yeah. So is it the same in California where you have a lot of corporate Democrats who many people think are kind of Republican light? Can you just give us a sense of what the political makeup is there?
Yeah, sure. There was a really interesting study by Demos about 6 months ago, and I was kind of waiting for somebody to do this study. I always wondered, like, if you look at all the money that comes into city campaigns, you know, for elected officials, where is that money coming from? So much of it was coming from white donors and from people outside the city. So outside the city, they want to see the investment where the investment already is. They want to see things trickle down. They want a good downtown. They want things in the city that will attract people from outside to spend money. But, you know, that leads to like retail jobs and doesn't make it out to the neighborhoods. So you do see, people call it a half a loaf kind of town. You know, a developer comes along and it's like, what tax breaks can we give you? Please stay. Please come. Please stay. And, you know, we have these organizations like the BDC, the Greater Baltimore Committee, who are kind of regional leaders who kind of determine the city's direction. After Freddie Gray, 97 people ran for office because it was a mayoral and city council election about a year after Freddie Gray. More than half the city council turned over. More than half the city council was under age 35. So you've seen some shakeup. But it's a strong mayor town, so the city council doesn't have that much power. And our mayors have just been, you know, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, who was mayor during Freddie Gray, she didn't even run for re-election. She seemed like she had had enough. And the mayor before her, Sheila Dixon, who more people seem to like, resigned after she got an embezzlement charge over some gift cards that she was alleged to have taken. Catherine Pugh resigned in disgrace. And so a strong mayor town with some weak mayors and all these problems and all this money coming in from the suburbs, you know, we have some strong, strong organizing, but it takes so long to get any kind of purchase. You know, like the organizing for the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, they got $20 million a year, but that took so long and so much passion and dedication. And that's just one thing. I mean, you are, when the bottom up meets the top down in this town, there's just so much distance between them.
Today, we are speaking with journalist Lawrence Lanahan about his new book, The Lines Between Us, Two Families and a Quest to Cross Baltimore's Racial Divide. When Lawrence was at WYPR in Baltimore, he produced a very long series, The Lines Between Us, which won a 2014 Alfred I. DuPont Award. And we should say we booked the show before Donald Trump's latest racist Twitter rant, which continues to receive widespread media coverage. Lawrence was a producer at WYPR, their Maryland Morning Show, from 2009 to 2013. We're in such I don't even know what to call it. Strange time, scary time. But I was thinking still about what Dr. Kay said about not being able to really criticize politicians at this time where Donald Trump is constantly going after specifically black politicians. And as you said, you know, it takes time. A lot of these mayors have failed. What are your thoughts about where that conversation should go, especially when you're talking about holding power accountable in a place like Baltimore, from the local to the federal level?
I don't want to sound hopeless. I'll let you hear me sound exhausted. You know, I've been here for 14 years. Why would anybody run? You're just going to step on a live wire the first day. Something has to happen to incentivize new, fresh leadership that is willing to step on that live wire and stay on it and push through. People who are willing to say no to the moneyed interests. People who don't care if they get another term.
Right.
People who have something to go back to if they lose. I really, you've stumped me. It's so hard here. It's
wow.
So tough. And we don't want to look for a hero or a savior, but we are looking for something to arise from below to carry the interests of the neighborhoods here. That you don't often feel. There are a few people in city council who are doing some good work for the neighborhoods, but as far as the system, you know, you push a little bit and it springs right back in your face.
Wow, if only the media could really just, you know, obviously mention Trump's tweet and say, okay, this is racist, but here's the real issue. And this is not just Baltimore. I mean, this, as you say, these issues are happening in so many cities across the country where, at the end of the day, it's money and politics, politicians not wanting to make the wrong people angry, and the people, as a result, especially the poor and a lot of people of color, as a result, are pushed out to the margins. And we should also, though, say, and I completely understand the fact that you're so tired. There's so many people doing such good work at the same time on the ground.
It's true. It's just they need to get a purchase on power.
Right.
All right. I see hopeful things, right? The big question in America right now is who gets to live where? You know, we have a housing crisis. We have an affordable housing crisis. Apparently, from the new reports, there just aren't enough homes, especially in California. And so you see people trying to answer this question in different ways, right? You guys had SB 50, which got tabled, but, you know, they were going to zone for more density around transit. And what it all comes down to is local control, right? People want to keep the character of their community. It's just sometimes the character of the community is money and whiteness. Advantages. And so the question is sort of like, how much control are people willing to give up at the local level? Minneapolis just voted to get rid of single family zoning. So did the Oregon State Legislature. I was stunned by that. I mean, I report on housing. Maybe I shouldn't have been. But in Montgomery County, Maryland, they wanted to pass a bill to make it easier to build auxiliary dwelling units, ADUs, which are just like little houses or whatever on your property. You know, and somebody down there said, oh, you're going to turn all of Montgomery County into a slum. And that's the language, right? The language of dehumanization. Like, you're going to turn this space, this prosperous space, this whiter space into something we associate with color and with stereotypes. So they passed it, though. They passed it unanimously. So you see people answering that question, who gets to live where, differently. And I got to tell you, man, from out here, California looks so bonkers to me.
Yeah.
What I say about structural racism and segregation and all this stuff, inequality, is that different regions may change the tune a little bit, but the song remains the same. Out here, we're desperate for investment. We're desperate for capital, and people feel stuck in the neighborhoods where they are. You guys, I mean, it's a tsunami of capital coming through the Bay Area. People are unstable in their housing and are having to move. The Haas Institute in Berkeley is doing this series about segregation. You know, you guys have a bigger Latino and Asian population than we have, but you still see whiteness congregating and the wealth congregating around it. You still see the effects of redlining and urban renewal in like Fillmore and San Francisco. So I really hope that, you know, if people outside of Baltimore read this book, that they kind of try to find their place in the story. The whole thing here with this book is like, it's the lines between us. It's us. You're not watching, like, observing some community from afar in some anthropological way. I put us in the title for a reason. If it's us, then you're in the story somewhere. So if you're a white person in the Baltimore region, you see a lot of the white people in this book aren't like default people. They're explicitly white, and they're being white in different ways. And so a white person reads the book in this region, they're like, oh, wait, which one of these people am I? Or what is my role in the way this region has come together? And, you know, I'd love to come out and spend some time in San Francisco and get a sense of how this story plays out in the Bay Area.
I mean, it's shocking. You know, you have $40 million condos being bought up so quickly, and then you have bodies on the streets. I mean, every time, you know, I meet a taxi driver or a tourist, I ask, the taxi drivers have the most amazing stories because, especially those who've been driving for many, many years. And then the tourists are utterly shocked at what they see on the streets.
Yeah.
And it's just getting worse.
Yeah, and it's coming for everybody, right? I mean, you have that version of inequality where it's just incredible amounts of homeless on the street. We have a version of inequality that is very specifically racialized and spatial, and both are epic in their own ways. And I just feel like if we leave things on autopilot, every region is going to see their own version of this incredible and inequitable suffering.
Right. You know, and Lawrence, it's so true when you're talking about inequality. I think what really gets me is when I read about CEO pay, I mean, it's shocking. 40,
what's it gone
40
from like 40 to 1 in the 80s
million.
To
right, 80
to
million
like 300 or 400 to 1?
Exactly. And then you look at just people trying to get by. You know, even the cooks and the janitors at Facebook trying to get by, the people driving for Uber and Lyft.
Where do they live? I mean, I don't know California that well. The people who are doing those jobs for Facebook and Twitter or whoever, where do they live?
Well,
like, how far are they commuting in from?
If, you know, some people do have rent-controlled apartments in San Francisco and the Bay Area.
Okay.
But they're, you know, in San Francisco, they're holding onto them because no one is guaranteed to stay in their rent-controlled apartment. And a lot of people are living... They drive an hour away, maybe even longer. I mean, you know, Uber and Lyft drivers often sleep in their cars because they live so far
isn't
away.
Is there like a caravan of RVs in Berkeley that they're trying
yes.
to get rid of?
Yes. In fact, we are now, it's so bad that cities are now basically designating certain parking lots as a safe place for you to park your RV.
We do make some weird accommodations for inequality in this country, don't we?
I mean, at the end of it, yes. It's
absurd at the end. It's like in Baltimore, you know, the only way to pull the rug out from under the stuff is to point out the absurdity, right? Like in Baltimore, there are all these big department stores downtown in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And when they finally let black people shop there, they're like, you can shop here, but you can't try on clothes. Mm. It's like, but you're selling clothes. It's just you point out the weirdness of the accommodations that... You know, like Thurgood Marshall here, we kind of desegregated one school in 52 here before Brown v. Board. Like, there is a black school, Frederick Douglass, which, by the way, is the school that let all the students out at Mondawmin Transit Hub that turned into the uprising here. Anyway, back in the day, some black students said, we're not getting a good enough engineering course here at Frederick Douglass. We want to go to Baltimore Polytechnic Institute and take their A course. And Thurgood Marshall, you know, went to the school board and was like, these boys want to go, of course, then it was boys, these boys want to go to Poly. And people were like, well, there's just as good, you know, it was separate but equal then. And they were like, oh, they get just as good engineering course at Frederick Douglass. He was like, no, they don't. And when they get out, they are not going to carry the prestige that they will carry coming out of Poly. And they let those kids in. They integrated Poly, Poly High School in 52 for these few students. Because Thurgood Marshall had called them on the absurdity. You got to look at the stuff like that.
Wow.
You know, and I think that's why part of the... I can talk about The Wire in Baltimore. We're not that tired of it. I mean, David Simon kind of highlighted the absurdity of dysfunctional institutions.
Right. That's
and
what
not,
I love
it's not for
it.
Chuckles. It's
no.
for like, oh my, that is that our country?
Yeah, I was addicted to that series. That's what I loved
it's
about
very good.
It. It's, I think it's very good. And David Simon has been just on fire on Twitter, as you know, probably have read over the last couple of weeks in response to Donald Trump. Lawrence, before we end, I just want to ask you, are you still in touch with Nicole Smith, the woman who lived in a high-rise public housing project and got a voucher to move with her son to Columbia, where she enrolled in community college, she started her own daycare, and then she got her son into high-performing schools. Are you still in touch?
I am, yeah. I took the book down. I'm in touch with a lot of the people, and I'm in touch with Mark and Betty. We didn't get to talk about them, but they're a white couple who, because of their evangelical faith, decided that they needed to give up their comfort in the white suburb of Bel Air, where I grew up, and move to Sandtown, the almost all-black poor neighborhood. They moved there in 2005, 10 years before Freddie Gray. But yeah, I'm in touch with all of them. You really grow to love these people. And it's a weird position to be in as a journalist because you have to keep your distance and keep your boundaries. But boy, do you learn their life stories and you get to care about them so much. They still talk to me. That's good.
Well, it is fascinating to read about Mark and Betty, and I never had heard of this Christian Community Development, which is an organization that believes if you want to help low-income people, you have to basically live beside them.
Yeah, and there's this term that really kills me. It just every day it dawns on me more what it means. The guy who invented Christian Community Development said, you know, if you just commute in and out of a poor black neighborhood or a poor neighborhood trying to help, you're actually more likely to hurt. You have to live there. He wants you to move into the neighborhood if you want to help it. And he says that's because the neighborhood has felt needs, not just needs, felt needs. And if you aren't there feeling those needs too, you're not going to understand the needs. And what is so compelling about this, and if there's one thing people get out of this book, and it's why I'm so glad you brought up Dr. K, is that you need to listen to black people. Listen to black people in black communities. They know what they need, right? And so that Christian community development is a way of binding souls, you know, of living and having the same things at stake. It's truly, truly stunning to see. And it's not just white people. It's middle-class people. They're black relocators, too. You know, but I just wanted to see people, I wanted readers to see a black or a white family, you know, crossing the lines into a poor black neighborhood and all that revealed about whiteness and blackness.
Lawrence Lanahan is an award-winning journalist and author of The Lines Between Us, Two Families and a Quest to Cross Baltimore's Racial Divide. Lawrence, thanks so much for your work. We'd love to have you back. Thank you for joining
us. Rose, you clearly engaged with this book so deeply, and I'm really touched, and I'm really glad you brought me back, and I would love to talk to you again.
Well, you do great work. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. You can find more information about Your Call and podcast our show, yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.